through research of the most profitable way to cash flow on real estate. At that time, I came across short-term rentals, and our first unit that we put up, with maybe an hour's worth of work a week, we were making half as much as we were making in the restaurant, working honestly 70 to 80 hours a week.
Welcome to Passive Income Pilots, where pilots upgrade their money. This is the definitive source for personal finance and investment tactics for aviators. We interview world-renowned experts and share these lessons with the flying community. So if you're ready for practical knowledge and insights, let's roll.
Hey, welcome back to Passive Income Pilots, everyone. I'm your host, Tate Duryea. My co-host, Ryan Gibson, here. Good to see you on another week.
Good to see you. And it's fun to kind of explore after just visiting the west coast of Washington and doing an Airbnb. You always wonder, how does one manage these properties and how does one sort of outsource or insource this? And it's fun to have another guest on the show to talk about everything Airbnb and how they set it up and best practices. So super excited that you got this guy to come on the show.
Yeah, this was one of my favorite conversations around short-term rentals. You know, we have a lot of pilots I know out there that can't qualify for the real estate professional status, which is difficult to get, but the short-term rental strategy can be very creative. To do a cost segregation study, it's considered active if the average rental is less than 7 days, or 7 days or less, I should say. And you can use that depreciation benefit off of that physical property with bonus depreciation against your W-2. So very, very excited. I'm actually using that strategy this year. Fun fact.
Oh, good.
We're under contract. Congrats. To buy a short-term rental.
Well, you have to let me know.
In Nevada, as we speak.
Well, you have to let me know where it is so I can go rent it from you.
I definitely will. It's going to be fun. So I had a lot of selfish questions that I didn't let on that during the show to Dan that I was actually under contract on a property, but a lot of selfish questions in there answering stuff that I'm sure everybody has.
Yeah. And I've always wondered, like, how do you find a good market for Airbnbs? How do you automate everything? You know, some best practices for guests. And it's just really cool. It's nice to dive in. And I think there'll be a lot of applicable information in this episode.
I'm going to be listening back to it in the next week, probably, yeah, before it even airs, to get all these nuggets. So I think people will really enjoy it. With that, let's get to the show. Dan Templin, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, really excited to talk to you. It's always great to talk to a fellow real estate professional who's passionate about passive income and real estate and all this stuff. Ryan and I are real estate guys, so excited to dive into it. Maybe you can give us a little bit more about your background, how you got into it, and you know, some stories around your real estate experience.
Absolutely. So my wife and I actually got started in real estate when she was still in college, and I graduated 2 years before her. And we bought a house and we flipped it. We bought it for like $15,000 and sold it for, I think it was $85,000.
Where was this?
And so we went to school in East Lansing at Michigan State University. And the house was in Owosso, which is like 45 minutes away. It's a really small town.
I've been to Owosso.
Okay.
Have you?
I've been to the Owosso airport.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Very cool.
That's like by Oscoda, right? Or something like that?
Yeah. Yeah, pretty close to there.
Fun fact, I've flown in there.
All right, sorry to cut you off.
Oh, no worries. Yeah, and so we sold it, made a good chunk of money, and the day after my wife graduated from college, we got the keys to, we used that money to buy a local dive bar from where I grew up. And we went ahead and remodeled it and put a new concept in there, a craft beer bar and pizza restaurant. And we knew we always wanted to get back into real estate, but we had to stabilize the restaurant, grow the business. And once we grew the business, we brought it from doing $100,000 a year, and we brought it up to over $1 million a year. We started investing in short-term rentals. And from there, we went into some small multifamily, like fiveplexes. We have a couple twoplexes. We have some single-family homes, and then we've got seven Airbnbs as well.
What attracted you to short-term rentals?
Is going to seem kind of, I like the restaurant industry, but the profit margins in the restaurant industry are, if you're doing a really, really good job, are 10%. So if you're killing yourself working 100 hours a week, doing $1 million in sales, you're lucky if you're making $100,000. And through research of the most profitable way to cash flow on real estate. At that time, I came across short-term rentals. And, you know, our first unit that we put up with maybe an hour's worth of work a week, we were making half as much as we were making in the restaurant working, honestly, 70 to 80 hours a week. So the cash flow is really what interested me. And I think the resource that a lot of people use that I definitely used is consuming as much information as I possibly could between YouTube, BiggerPockets. And actually, I came across, I'm not sure if you're familiar with him, kind of in the beginning of when he started doing online classes. His name is Brian Page. And I took that course and it really accelerated my understanding and kind of gave us a blueprint of where to start.
Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
About that program?
That program, yeah. Maybe we could throw it in the show notes.
He started his program based around people who maybe don't have enough money to invest traditionally in real estate and to go and do rental arbitrage. So you go and find somebody with a house or even a multifamily that you approach them and say, hey, I want to rent this, but I want to rent it and put it on Airbnb and be upfront about it. And it was a system for doing that. And that's actually how we got into our first Airbnb, was doing it, because I kind of had cold feet about putting a bunch of cash into a deal. And within a year, we were actually able to buy that unit that we were doing arbitrage in from the landlord. So I didn't follow exactly what he recommended doing, you know, keep just duplicating that process, because we really wanted equity over time, you know, long-term wealth instead of just cash flow, kind of wanted it all. So, but yeah, it was a great course and definitely learned a lot from it.
Effectively, it's a way to make money on real estate without putting any money down. I mean, that's amazing. Like, oh, I don't have any money. I don't know where to start. I don't know how to do it. And that rental arbitrage was an absolute explosion in the industry that allowed people to get into real estate with really no cash. What's interesting, I mean, even a crash pad, I know, Dan, you don't know what a crash pad is, or maybe you do, but it's a pilot housing around airports that, you know, kind of serve pilots. That's kind of how I got started in real estate. And that was almost no money down, except that I actually had to furnish the apartment with bunk beds and dishes and all that stuff that the pilot would typically need. Did you have to do the same thing? I mean, did you have to, that was probably your money up front in the rental arbitrage, maybe out with some, what kind of cost goes into that?
So for our first unit, we used a lot of extra things that we had. And once we got to multiple units, obviously we had to start buying those things that we couldn't supplement any more extra things laying around. But I would say that for a 2-bedroom, you're looking at $7,000 to $15,000 in what you need to buy, because like you said, it's everything that you need for someone to feel like they're at home. So, and we have checklists for all this type of stuff too. And if people DM me, I'm happy to send those out to them. But there's things you would never even think of. Like you need, if you have one bed, you need 3 mattress protectors for that bed. You need, you know, 6 sets of sheets. You need, if you're able to sleep 6 people, we always put 24 towels in. Well, you need 3 rotations of that. Towels are not inexpensive. The list goes on and on of the things that you need to make sure that you're giving a great experience to a guest.
Yeah, the point I wanted to make too was people always say, well, that's a no money down real estate strategy, but you still had to spend money.
So absolutely, yeah. Like, there's still upfront costs.
Yeah.
You have to pay utilities. You have to put a deposit down. You know, if rent's $2,000 a month, it could cost you $6,000 to even get the place, you know, under a rental agreement if you have a security deposit first and last month's rent. So
I want to kind of dig into this a little bit, because this might be a good strategy for, say, you know, a brand new FO who doesn't have, you know, deep pockets to go and buy their first property in order to sort of juice their cash flow. But, you know, what are your thoughts on doing this behind, you know, a landlord's back, or like, do you have to?
I would highly not recommend doing that.
Right. Okay. That was my question, because it seems to me, because I've never done this. I have some friends that have, they've done it with consent and without consent. And it seems it would make me nervous to go and spend, you know, $15,000, $20,000 on a bunch of furniture for a place. If, you know, if then they found out that it was on Airbnb, they wanted to kick you out. Right.
Right. Yeah. That it can definitely void your lease. In most states, in the residential agreement, there is a part that says that you're not allowed to rent it out to someone else. can't sublease it, can't run a business out of it. So they have a couple strikes against you to be able to evict you if you do, you know, try to pull something over on them. And I always feel like being upfront about that type of thing is super important, just because you want to have a good relationship and you don't want your guests to feel awkward. I've stayed in Airbnb where the check-in instructions came in that day and they're like, don't mention this is an Airbnb in the check-in instructions. So then I'm like, okay, now I feel really awkward there.
How does that conversation go with the landlord if it's not in the rental agreement? So if you're looking at a place, you're like, oh, this is perfect. You look at the rental agreement.
How can you talk to them to say that you want to do that and change the lease?
Well, or if you look at it and you look at the lease and it doesn't specifically prohibit it.
Oh,
but what does the conversation look like around actually being upfront and telling them this is your intention?
So what I teach people is don't waste the landlord's time. Be upfront with them. It's one of the first things out of your mouth, you know, after you say hello, basically, because the way that we set up Airbnbs is we want to automate everything. So that means that you have to change locks because you need automated locks with codes that automatically come out. If it is a multifamily, you have to be able to have a keypad on the outside. And there's just a lot of things that you want to be upfront with them about because you need a little bit of special treatment. A lot of times you're not allowed to switch out locks, you know, that's in a lot of leases. So what we do is we have a pre-template rider that we give to landlords, and actually a couple of my students have used it and it's super easy. They can just put it on and it basically says, I give them permission to put this unit on Airbnb. And then we just strike out the parts in the lease where it says that, you know, you can't pre-rent it out or use it for commercial activity.
I always find that real estate is three things: market, asset quality, and location. And so when I think of an Airbnb and looking at a market and then finding the asset and the location, when I think of like Airbnbs, my personal use is like, you know, I go to a city and I'm renting something like downtown in like Washington, D.C. or San Francisco, or I'm going to some remote, you know, cool, like I just rented an Airbnb and just outside of Mount Rainier, you know, for the weekend, you know, really exclusive. I feel like I don't have the biggest picture here, though. I feel like there's more. Like if you're finding these rental properties that somebody's trying to rent out and you're coming in and you're approaching these people, how do you find that market? And like what makes a good location, asset quality? What are you kind of scanning for where you go, aha, that is exactly what I'm looking for, versus something that would be like, dude, you're an idiot for thinking that that's going to work out as an Airbnb? Kind of what are the left and right limits there?
Basically, what I tell people is if there's hotels in your area, people are traveling in your area. A short-term rental, a lot of people in their mind, it's tied into being a vacation rental. And people travel for all types of reasons other than just vacation, right? So one of our Airbnbs is in a town of, it's like 800 people. And the market rent in that area is like $1,200. And this is a brand new, you know, 14-foot ceiling, totally remodeled little downtown apartment that it's a one bedroom. But we're able to get $3,000 or $4,000 a month out of that because of it being a short-term rental versus a long-term rental. And people travel for all sorts of reasons. You know, they're coming to visit family. It's a seed corn capital of the world. So we get a lot of business people coming in, staying for 10 days, 30 days that are going to Monsanto, or there's just a lot of reasons other than vacation that people travel. And now that doesn't mean that you can just take any unit in the entire world and throw it on Airbnb, because when you pull up to an Airbnb, you don't want to look at it and be afraid to go inside, right? And if you go inside, it needs to be make people feel like they're, I always say at home, but obviously not at home, but you need to be able to offer all the amenities and comforts that people expect at home and for them to feel comfortable. One of the huge benefits to renting an Airbnb over a hotel is that you have all the amenities of home. You have a yard that you can walk in if you're doing, you know, a single family house instead of an apartment. You've got full laundry. You've got a full kitchen. And people, especially if they're doing an extended stay, really appreciate that. So when you find a unit that you think you might put on Airbnb, you can use a software called AirDNA, and AirDNA pulls from the back end of Airbnb and Vrbo. Some people call it VRBO, And they pull all the back-end information from hotels. And that will give you a very good idea of what you could expect for that size unit with that many bedrooms, with that many guests in that exact location.
Does AirDNA have a real expensive subscription, or can you, how does it work?
So that changed recently. AirDNA, you used to buy by market. So if you were looking,
it was like,
say,
CoStar.
What's that?
It was like CoStar, I think, right? You had to buy a market and subscribe to a market. Right.
And they just changed it now to where you have to buy a monthly subscription to use it. But there's another company that we actually use as well called Price Labs. And Price Labs originally just did automation of pricing because they're tied into all that same data.
Okay.
So sorry, I'm kind of going on a tangent here, but Price Labs will take a listing that you have on Airbnb or Vrbo, and it will automatically set prices based on the market. And if it sees that hotels 6 months from now are at $500 a night where they're normally $250, even though Price Labs doesn't know what event is coming, it knows there is an event coming, so it automatically changes your prices. And they,
this was also actually one of my questions for later on, so this is great.
Okay. And so they recently launched a market dashboard. And so that's very similar to the software being able to tell you what you're going to be able to do per year out of that property. And so we always recommend checking multiple sources because you're never going to get a perfect answer for what a property is going to do a year. And so the more data points that you can collect, the better idea you have. So
what hotels would be good hotels and bad hotels? I mean, are Motel 6s and Red Roof Inns as good as Holiday Inn Expresses and Hampton Inns? Or
it really depends on what type of unit you're looking to put in. So if you wanted to put in a luxury short-term rental, you would want hotels in your area that are luxury hotels. Or if you're trying to put in a low dollar per night short-term rental, you'd want to be around, you know, Best Westerns or Holidays and that type of thing. So it, you can use it kind of as a mirror of what you're trying to put into that area. Because if you put something into the middle of a cornfield and market it $1,000 a night, you're going to have a really hard time, you know, renting that out.
So I've got a question for you on, you know, you said, yeah, you obviously can't be scared to go into it, right? So I have a question on how to differentiate yourself from other Airbnbs in the area. To sort of preface this, we last year ran a fund for an institutional short-term rental operator who has been very successful in getting much higher nightly rent and much higher occupancy than competitor properties. And they do this by taking these properties and basically doing a renovation on them, but making them super Instagrammable. They do murals on the walls. And they'll theme the properties that, like, they have a Barbie house and a Saturdays are for the boys bachelor pad, you know, house. And not that anybody here wants to, you know, create a party house for their personal portfolio. But, you know, what are some things that you can do to really drive occupancy and revenue to your property versus other ones in the market?
Sure. So I want to preface that by saying that we keep hearing about the Airbnb bust, right? And what I feel like really happened is because my units are killing it, and I don't feel that at all, is that a lot of people who are way too casual about it got into the short-term rental game. And I have a very specific list of things to do to launch a unit to make sure that you're a market leader. And part of that, even things as simple as getting professional photography done of your unit, is one of the most valuable things you can do. And people aren't willing to spend $300 or $400 to have a professional come and take pictures. But I don't know if you've ever scrolled through Airbnb, and you can tell a huge difference between people who spent the money and people who did not. Another, like, hack, I guess you could say, is what you're talking about, is making them very Instagrammable and making moments for them inside the unit, like having a selfie wall with, you know, your hashtag that you want them to use when they're posting it, things like that. There's a lot of good hacks like that. But honestly, the best way that you can get the most monthly rent, or not rent, but income off of a unit, is by setting it up correctly, managing it properly, getting great reviews, and setting it up for who you have in mind. You know, if you're setting up a unit for a family, you have to make sure that you have, a good example is like a pack and play, which is like a mobile crib, so that families, you know, have some place that their baby can sleep comfortably, having a baby tub so that they can, you know, wash the baby, having extra sheets, the right amount of towels, just really making sure that you have the amenities for the people that you're targeting, and really following through with great customer service are the best ways, I believe, to differentiate yourself.
What about repeat business? I mean, I rent the same cabin every year for a hike that I do with my friends. And sure. I have a hell of a time. Like, I want to rent it. I want to rent it for like the next 3 or 4 years, the same weekend, same time. We do the same trip. But man, it feels like there's not technology that exists for that. Do you guys do anything that kind of makes it so I can come back to the same place every year and book today? I mean, how do you guys handle that?
Repeat business is huge, and that's part of doing a great job, making sure the amenities are there and making sure that you have great customer service, because you're not going to want to go back there if it was a terrible experience, right? But I know exactly what you're talking about with it's hard to rebook. And the reason for that is all the short-term rental platforms give you an availability calendar, and typically hosts set it to 6 months or 1 year. And you can put it on open so that you can go open into the future. But a lot of people don't want to do that, because if they sell the property, they, especially with how strict Airbnb has become recently, they're going to owe that money to Airbnb. So say that you wanted to book your next 3 years, and altogether it was, I don't know, $10,000. And they went to sell the property. If they didn't have the right cancellation policy in place, they could owe Airbnb that money when they cancel it. But you can ask your host, if you send them a message over Airbnb, or I don't know if you use Vrbo, but you can ask them to open their calendar temporarily, and then you can book those out so that you don't have to sit and wait for it to come out and hope that someone else doesn't take it. And if they know what they're doing, they'll know how to open up their calendar for you, and they'll be able to let you book it.
What about taking customers off of the platform? So if Ryan wanted to communicate directly with the host of this property and say, you know, hey, can we just connect offline and create a side agreement where I'd like to book this out for the next few years, whatever, this is my information. And not, because I know that the booking fees are steep. And I know that you know, some people have created a whole business around sort of poaching customers over time, and then creating their own booking system with a handful.
Yeah, that's where I was going, because I was like, I feel like I would want to proffer the guest, like, hey, here's my personal cell phone number. If you ever want to, you know, connect on anything, I don't know,
right?
Somehow, like because this year I finally was like, you know, I texted the lady. I was like, this is my third year in a row staying here. You know, looking forward to doing it again next year. And all of a sudden she kind of got the hint, like, oh, here's my cell phone number. Don't book through Airbnb. It's really expensive. It just booked directly through me. And I was kind of like, oh, okay. Well, yeah, I would have done that 3 years ago if you would have just told me. So yeah, great follow-up.
So direct booking is a great thing. And the software that I was talking about before, Hospitable, has it so you can make your own direct booking website, and then that integrates automatically. So if they wanted to fill you in, it would block out the calendar so that other people couldn't book those days. It's always kind of a touchy subject though, because you're breaking the terms of service for Airbnb and Vrbo if you reach out to the guest and say that, because obviously that cuts into their future income. And so what a lot of guests will do is, and I'm sure you've seen them, but you can have a host book when you go into an Airbnb and it'll open up. Well, you can have a QR code inside that guest book, and that will bring them to like, hey, did you stay here? Did you enjoy the experience? Want to come back? Save some money next time and book direct through our direct booking website. I have heard stories of Airbnb sending employees out when they hear that type of stuff is happening. I've never experienced it, but I've heard it on other podcasts of that happening. And there's always risk reward, right? And Airbnb is expensive. You see one side of it, but they take more from the host's payout than what you're seeing that you're paying. So it's beneficial both ways for sure to do direct booking. And a lot of people, their goal is to get to 80% plus of direct repeat business because it is such a, I mean, you can increase your income by 20% by not going through Airbnb easily.
I was curious to see what that percentage was, about 20%.
Yeah, it depends on what you count in there. You always have to pay your taxes regardless. Then you have to submit those on your own to the state or your city. And it depends on how large the unit is and how long the booking is. There's no like set fee. So
got it. So I want to transition into software. I also have a stat here that I wanted to read out because the Airbnb bust, as they call it, I think has to do with so much supply coming on the market. But this last August was the biggest ever with 21.2 million nights booked in short-term rentals. So even though the demand is cooling and the, you know, the explosive growth is starting to plateau, we saw, August demand grew 7.6% year over year compared to 9.3% year over year growth in July. But, you know, this past month was the biggest ever. So anyway, what are your recommendations on software? You've got some great tips. Let's dive into software. You have an ebook on how to automate guest communication. So let's dive into your, I don't know, top five favorite software platforms that can help you set up and automate an Airbnb business.
Sure. So the glue that holds everything together is a software called Hospitable. Hospitable will create a listing off the listings that you made on Airbnb, Vrbo, your direct site, and Expedia. So if somebody books on Vrbo, it feeds to Hospitable. It blocks out the same unit on all the other platforms. And then you also do all of your guest communications over Hospitable so that you don't have to keep, you know, the Airbnb app up. You don't have to keep the Vrbo app up, and everything is consolidated into one. And then within Hospitable, there's a thing called automations. And the ebook that you're talking about, I wrote an ebook detailing how to automate guest communications, and that is the Auto Host Mastery. That triggers responses to when somebody has an inquiry, when somebody makes a booking, when, you know, 24 hours before their arrival, an hour before their arrival, checking in on them during their stay, all the way to automatically requesting a review and automatically writing a review for them. So if I was managing 7 units without automation, it would be like a 60-hour a week job writing all these messages. I'm sure messages would be missed. And this really streamlines the guest experience and makes it as great as possible. It doesn't fix everything. If someone messages you and says, "Where's the toaster?" you're not going to be able to, you know, automate that. But you can have canned responses, which are saved responses that you can save, like, how far is it to X stadium or something like that? If they're common questions, they're not perfectly automated, but you can save canned responses. So that's Hospitable. The next piece of software that I always recommend everyone gets is Price Labs. Price Labs tells you what it thinks the market value is of your unit, and you tell it what you want per night and the occupancy that you want, and it gives you the recommendations and automatically changes your pricing, and it automatically adjusts it based on demand. You can give it a floor and you can give it a ceiling if you'd like. And when we switched to using Price Labs, we saw probably a 30% increase in revenue. It's really a powerful tool, and it's all automated, and it will run directly through Hospitable. On top of that, the next piece of software is automated locks. It's huge because you can control the locks from anywhere, and you don't have to manually put in codes. And I always say the most important thing when you're hosting is guest safety, and not having to have guests share codes is huge for me. Literally, when someone books, within 1 second, they get a message with their code. It's time stamped from their check-in time to their checkout time. And that is something that a lot of hosts deal with. They try to manually do that, or they try to use the same code and change it every 2 months. And I just don't see that as a viable option. The other piece of software that we use is we do use security cameras on the exterior of our units. Obviously, it's nothing on the inside, but on the outside, just to monitor safety, make sure that there's no parties or anything like that going on. And that is, we use Blink, and it's great because you can put different properties in and have it all through one app.
What you mentioned parties, and I'm really glad you brought that up, because I feel like I've heard, you know, if you've got more than 9 guests or 10 guests that can book your property, you're probably asking yourself for a party.
Sure.
What is your prime setup for guest count?
So, I mean, it really depends on what you're trying to do. I'll give you an example. One of our units is it's like a 4,000 square foot old Victorian in downtown Kalamazoo, Michigan. And it has a first floor apartment and it has a second floor apartment. And we book it 3 different ways. We book it as first floor, we book it as second floor, or we book it as whole house. And it gets booked whole house probably about 30 to 40% of the time, and it can sleep 12 people. And we really don't have a problem with parties. I think in all the years we've been doing it, maybe we've had 2 parties, and that was right when we were starting out and we didn't really know what we were doing. But you can put things in your unit such as noise, and I believe you talked about this on one of your previous podcasts, but you can put things in that monitor noise levels. They don't record anything, and we do have those in the units. And the optimal really is what is more heads in beds is what everyone always says, right? Because then you can drive more dollars to the top line. And so as many people as you can fit in a unit comfortably is what I recommend doing. So if it's a 2-bedroom, maybe you can put a pull-out sofa in. And as long as you're very clear in your description that you have 2 bedrooms and then 2 of the people, because it says you can sleep 6, and you're very clear that 2 of them would have to sleep on a pull-out, we've never had an issue with that. And people understand that and they expect that. So
makes sense.
You talked about the electronic locks. What brand do you use? Are they connected to the internet so that that's all automated? How does that all tie in?
So Yale recently bought a company called August. We were originally using just August locks, and Yale bought them. And any lock that is, I can't say any of their e-locks, but a large amount of their e-locks integrate automatically with Airbnb. So when you set it up, it's connected to the internet and you kind of are the master of that lock in your phone. And when you assign it to a unit and Airbnb gets a booking, it literally automatically sends it right over within a second. So
that's super cool. Does it integrate with Hospitable and the other platforms, or is it just one, or? What does that look like?
So you can integrate it. It looks a little different. You can't do it directly into Hospitable. It's something that they're working on, but you can integrate it with Vrbo. So
that's awesome.
Now, I was just at a property management, or I was out at a kind of a town in Washington where there's a lot of houses you can buy that are in this like really stood up community. It almost looks like the Truman Show. It's called Seabrook, Washington. Great place to go, by the way. Take your kids. I get the sense that when you buy in that community, you're kind of like beholden to like the one property management company in town, because they hold like all the monopoly over like the cleaners, and you're kind of in the middle of nowhere. Now, there isn't a requirement to use their property management company, of course. But speak to that. I mean, there's lots of places in Washington like that. Clee Ellum, you can go out to Suncadia, just a really dialed in, kind of stood up community for this. You know, Seabrook is another example of that. I can think of others, probably like in Chelan, there's this place called The Lookout. When you buy in those communities, do you self-automate? Do you kind of try to run it on your own versus going with the property management company that's sort of in that market? You know, how do you kind of decipher between the two?
So it really comes down to what situation you're in, right? If you are going to be working and you know that there's going to be 10-hour windows where you're not available to respond to a guest, you're not going to be able to self-manage unless you build a team and you hire a VA to respond to guest communications and to deal with any guest problems that can then reach out to your local handyman. We always talk about building a team, and I teach people how to build, you know, your cleaning team, your handyman team, all that type of stuff. And so you can go as hands-on as you want to as hands-off as you want. And every degree that you move away from hands-on, you're obviously affecting profitability. So it really just depends on what people are looking for and also what type of strategy they're using for tax deductions as well. Personally, I self-manage. I always keep one of our units on that I personally self-manage. We have somebody that manages five of them. So I manage one that has two in it because that gives me, we run cost segregation studies on them. Bingo. And then we're able to get huge tax benefits from that. So it really depends on where people are that are at and how much time they can give to managing it.
When we've talked about cost segs on previous episodes, if this is the first episode you're listening to, go back and listen to the episode with Toby Mathis, number 10 and 14. They're fantastic. We just did an episode with Yona Weiss talking specifically about cost segregation studies. A lot of pilots are unable to get real estate professional status because that's a bit of a lift. But this short-term rental hack and being able to self-manage an STR, which is considered active now, and you can use the cost segregation and bonus depreciation to offset your active income, is an incredible benefit. So yeah, what are your thoughts on, you know, somebody lives in a market that doesn't necessarily make sense. They can't drive to an Airbnb that really makes sense for them. Their market's super expensive and they want to manage it out of state. They need to be hands-on. They need to manage it themselves, but it's out of state. It's from afar. Do you think that's possible? What are some tips that you have for those people?
Oh, sure. I have two thoughts on that. One is if you're looking into a specific market that's outside of yours. I don't know if you guys are familiar with Avery Carl from the Short Term Shop. She has a great podcast, and she's owns a brokerage with EXP, and they specifically teach people how to do that. That's part of the deal is like, okay, you're going to use us. We're experts. We only do short-term rentals. And if you come into this specific market, we know all the people in this market. So finding an expert in your market to help you. The second is that you can actually build your own team with a VA, and you can find VAs on Upwork or, you know, sites like that who specialize in responding or running short-term rentals for people. But you're still responsible for the unit at that point. You're not hiring a management company. And so you still are running it and you have access to the day-to-day. All you're doing is giving them access to your hospitable and replying to messages, but you're still the boss in charge. But you don't maybe, you know, if you miss a question about someone being locked out because they couldn't find their code, you still have someone, you know, if you're tied up to deal with the emergencies, you have somebody at a very reasonable cost to deal with small problems that come up and are able to bring out your handyman or your cleaning crew if need be.
I'm sure you could find somebody on onlinejobs.ph as well. That's a fantastic website for work in the Philippines, which that's where I found one of my employees who's full-time now, and they're just fantastic. So you can find all sorts of people there that are overseas that might be able to run, you know, 24 hours with a couple people.
I was just going to say a lot of
Right. One thing before we move off the cost segregation and the short-term rental strategy here, I do want to point out the requirement of, in order for it to be considered active, the average stay has to be 7 days or less. Is that correct?
I believe so.
So Dan, one thing that we always kind of wrap up with is something that you have learned in the last 6 months that has been the most impactful to what you're doing in short-term rentals. Like, what's the one nugget that you've really pulled away and you're like, man, if I would have known this when I started, or this new piece of legislation is really going to change the way this looks at something, you know, just, I try to make it as open-ended as I possibly can, but
sure.
Yeah, the biggest takeaway in the last 6 months that really is going to change or revolutionize your business.
So this was actually just recently, but we talked about a little bit how I made a booklet teaching people how to automate their guest communications. And an epiphany that I had, and it's not specifically just for short-term rentals, but it's just kind of business in general, is when you know something in your head, you always feel like, I know it, I don't need to review it. But once I laid everything out and I looked at specifically our entire game plan for guest automation, there were so many things that I found that we were doing okay on, but that we could have been doing a lot better on. And I think that it's really taught me that if I want to improve on some parts of my business, that I need to sit down and I need to write out exactly, like I'm teaching people, how to do it, because there's so many epiphanies that I had through the process that are very valuable to me and that are going to be valuable to my guests. And I'm going to take that concept and I'm going to keep on writing more of these booklets, because I feel like I'm almost teaching myself how to be better when I'm writing them. I don't know if that's what you're looking for, but that's the biggest epiphany I've had recently.
No, that makes a lot of sense. And when you say writing them down, are you saying like KPIs or just measurable things that you want to reflect on, or what is that?
I mean, I guess it would depend on what it is you're discussing, because with guest communication, you can't really have KPIs unless you're giving guest surveys and you could put like a number on those, sure. Right? But I definitely think that it just would depend on exactly what part of your business or your life you're trying to improve. But anytime you can write anything down and really work through it, even if you think you have a great handle on it, I think you always have room to improve.
Makes sense.
I'm sure we're going to have a lot of people downloading this ebook. You talk about streamlining guest communications and sort of templatizing all these different things. Is that something that do you hand over that document to a VA if you hire them, or a set of VAs? Or how does that integrate with the whole using someone else? Because a lot of us, you know, if we are airborne without Wi-Fi for 10 hours, that's a big problem, right? So how do those two pieces fit together, the VA and the automating guest communication?
So the automating you can set up on your own, or you could give it over to your VA to set up, because those are all the automatic things that are going to get sent out. But in the booklet, I talk about the rule of two, and that means that if you have to say something more than twice to two different guests, you know, like type out a response, then you save those. And that's the same that we use, the same philosophy we use for building out a Google sheet for each individual property. So if people always have a question about a feature in one of the properties, if we can't work that into feeding the information preemptively, we work it into adding it to the spreadsheet for that property, so that it doesn't matter who's doing the responses. They can do a quick search and find if there's already the answer. And if the answer isn't there, then they add it once they figure out the answer.
That's excellent.
I don't know if that makes sense, but
that makes total sense. Ryan, I got one more thing, unless you have something that you wanted to throw in there.
No, beforehand. I just wanted to say this has been so helpful for somebody who is thinking about, you know, sort of evaluating a market, somebody who wants to automate their process, somebody who is thinking about, you know, where to locate or what factors to look for and where to put an Airbnb. And really, Dan, you know, just to be more direct, I mean, a coach, right? Somebody that can actually, they can connect with an expert to learn about Airbnbs, you know? So that's really the value that we're trying to bring to the show, which is, hey, if you are thinking about doing an Airbnb, there's a lot of free resources and toolkits and things like that you can download, you know, in the show notes with Dan. But really, if you want to kind of really professionalize and get serious about it, there's experts out there that can help you do that. And so, you know, really appreciate you coming on and sharing that wisdom. But go ahead, Tate, sorry.
So I wanted to just touch on this point about the average 7-day stay, average 7 days or less in order to get the active status, right? Ryan, you remember that with Toby Mathis. Dan, are you familiar with that in terms of, you know, in order for the activity to be classified as active. And in order to be able to use that bonus depreciation to offset your W-2 income, if that's the strategy you're trying to use, make sure that your average length of stay is 7 days or less, because otherwise you're going to blow up the active status. So I just wanted to touch briefly on maximum stays. You mentioned that people might stay for 2 weeks or a month. How do you handle that on the projects that you self-manage? Now, Dan, you're likely a real estate professional, so it doesn't really matter for you.
Right. But how, in many ways.
Right. But how would you manage that if you're not a real estate professional and you need your average stay to be less than 7 days? Can you set a maximum number of days on hospitable?
Oh, absolutely. You can set a maximum or a minimum number of days. And
what's the magic number to optimize? Like, there should there be a minimum, and what should the maximum be?
It depends on the market you're in. It depends what type of property it is. If you have a really awesome house that's huge and you're afraid of parties, don't allow one nights, because a bunch of kids can throw together $2,000 pretty easy, right? But it's a lot more painful to throw together $4,000 to rent that out. I always recommend never going over 30 days. In most states, people get tenant rights after that. And so then you may have to deal with evictions. And I don't think that the average, depending on the property and depending on the market, that keeping an average of below 7 days would really be an issue. From what I've always seen, our average is much lower than 7 days. But it's something that you can actively monitor and you can adjust as needed. So if you are halfway through the year and you're like, oh man, you know, we're not going to hit the 7 days, you can go in and change any settings that you want. And you can do that through Price Labs, or you can do it natively on any of the platforms if you're not using Price Labs and you're just on Airbnb trying to wing it. So
that is absolute gold. All right, Dan, how can people find out more about you, download the ebook, get more access to all this stuff?
Sure. They can visit dantemplin.com, or they can find me on Instagram. I'm pretty active on there. The businessman_Dan.
Excellent.
Thanks for coming on, Dan.
Well, thank you so much. This has been incredible.
Thank you so much for having me on. It was a great conversation.
We really appreciate all the value you brought, and we look forward to connecting with you soon.
Sounds good. Thanks, guys.